Chanette is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Stay with us as we discuss capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Dale Chanette in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Professor Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Dr. James Acker, professor at the School of Criminal Justice, State University of New York at Albany, and co-editor of a new book, The Future of America's Death Penalty. The Execution Watch begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. A little croupy tonight because of a persistent cough. I hope I don't break into a fit while we're on the air. Dale Devon Skianet, as according to the AP wire pronunciation, originally a native of Louisiana. He is now 35 years old. He was 22 or 23 years old when a series of crimes happened in Fort Worth, Texas. He is being executed for the rape and slaying of a woman, victim in this case, and there were other crimes implicated. There doesn't seem to be a significant issue of guilt or innocence, but the case progressed through the courts, in trial court and in the appeals, gave us plenty of things to be discussing. We're waiting for our connection to Professor Dr. Dennis Longmire, who is at the vigil in Huntsville, to tell us whether or not the procedure has begun up there. And as soon as our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein, gets that all lined up, we will bring you a report from there. Are we ready? Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray. How are you?
I wish we had more pleasant things to discuss, but I am fine. What's going on?
Well, all the witnesses for the media have already gone in. They went in about 4 or 5 minutes ago. We have not seen any other group of witnesses cross the street. That could mean that there are no witnesses for Dale tonight, or it could mean that his witnesses are taking a longer time to get themselves together. But we do know that the media has already gone in, and so there's a very good possibility that the execution is already underway.
How many folks you have tonight?
There are five of us on the corner. Actually, there's one man. He comes down regularly about 4 or 5 times a year. He has a prison ministry, and he comes down from the Dallas area. He actually lived very near where the crime occurred, and so if you'd like, he said he is willing to talk with you.
Okay. Is he there now? Or?
Yes, he is. One second. His name is Richard.
Okay.
Richard. This is the radio.
He gets Richard for the phone. We have somebody that's...
Yes, there you go. Hello?
Hello, Richard.
Uh-huh.
Yes, this is Ray Hill. You're on Execution Watch. Tell us, what do you know of these cases? Richard?
Uh-huh.
Are you there?
Uh-huh.
What do you know about these cases?
Yeah, I got a prison free outreach. I'm the founder of Prison Free Outreach Ministry.
Okay, but you were living in the area where these cases...
Oh, yeah, I live about 7 miles away from the crime scene. It was a high profile at the time that the crime was committed. It went unsolved for, like, I think 11 years, and it was a pretty bad case for Tarrant County.
And so tell us about your ministry.
What's that?
Tell us about your ministry.
Oh, I go into the bird unit, I go into the holiday unit, I go into the prison out in Abilene, prison out in El Paso. We minister to the people inside the prison, inside the Dallas County Jail. We feed the homeless, clothe the homeless. Do services outside of downtown Dallas. I feed about 300 homeless people on Sunday afternoon.
Do you find yourself dealing with the same people in prison that you deal with in the homeless population?
Correct.
Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate your being on the air with us. Y'all keep vigil. Tell Dennis if anything happens to get in touch with us.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you, sir.
You got my number?
We've got the numbers.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, God bless.
Bye-bye. And now that we have been blessed, Jim, tell us about this case.
Well, what happened, Ray, this apparently from the articles I read occurred in an apartment complex in Arlington. And those of you who are not familiar with this area, it's around the Dallas-Fort Worth area, closer to Fort Worth than Dallas. And in the latter part of 1999, in September, there was a lady named Christine Vu. I guess it's Vu. That's how you pronounce it, it's a Vietnamese name. I was found in an apartment complex, and she had been strangled to death. And what happened, they found her partly submerged in a bathtub of water. And somebody had tied duct tape around her neck, had tied duct tape around her ankles, around her wrist, and strangled her to death. And she'd been sexually assaulted as well as drowned. And they had absolutely no leads to it. And unfortunately, this occurred in September of 1999. And then in December the 24th, the same year, about 2 months later, in the same apartment complex, another woman by the name of Christine, Wendy Prescott, I'm sorry, 20-year-old girl, was found the same way. This guy, Wendy Prescott, was killed the same way. She, too, was in a bathtub, partly submerged with water. There was duct tape around her neck. Her hands were taped behind her back as well as her ankles. And the phrase that lawyers use a lot and you hear a lot in court, they call this a fingerprint crime. Because you'll hear that oftentimes in case law. They talk about a fingerprint crime because the modus operandi is the same. They have the same duct tape, the same taping, the same strangling, the same submerging in the bathtub.
And duplicates.
They call that. The nickname they use is a fingerprint murder.
And dealing with duct tape, you can leave some fingerprints.
Right. So what happened, they did find fingerprints at both locations. That's about all they had. Now, this occurred in 1999, and they called them the bathtub killers, who they nicknamed this guy the bathtub killer.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's terrified. I can imagine anybody living in an apartment complex would be terrified about this. And the murders went unsolved until something like the year 2000. And what had happened, due to some advanced fingerprint technology, they were able to match up this print with this particular defendant, Skinette, I guess it's Skinette. It's Dale Skinette. He'd been busted on account of a minor burglary.
I think AP pronounced it Chianette.
Chianette. So they matched the fingerprints with Chianette, and once they get him arrested based upon the fingerprints, there's a DNA match, and the DNA matches both murder cases. And so they seek a death penalty case, and after they solve this death penalty case, lo and behold, there's something like 5 additional sexual assault cases that crop up in which women come to court during the trial and identify him as being the one that raped and assaulted him. And what happened, all 5 of those women testified during the punishment hearing as to getting beat up and doing acts of violence and being repeatedly required to do sexual acts on this guy. So what happened, you had fingerprint evidence, DNA evidence linking him to the murders, which is awful solid proof. Then you've got 5 additional women coming forward identifying him as being the one that brutally raped and assaulted them.
That evidence would only be admissible in the punishment phase.
At the punishment phase. And there are some instances where it could come in at punishment. In this particular case, it came in at the punishment phase as opposed to the guilt or innocence phase. And really, all you need in a case like this, truthfully, I felt sorry for the defense lawyers, there's no way in the world you're going to be able to, there's an old phrase that fingerprints don't lie, but liars take fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can argue that point, but you've also got the DNA evidence to worry about. And that's pretty hard stuff to overcome when you've got DNA proof linking a person to a crime plus fingerprint evidence linking somebody to a crime, and the guy doesn't testify and has no alibi and no explanation for it. You're pretty well sunk. And then once they find him guilty, then they prove up the fact that he's linked to a second capital murder in which a woman was killed in the same apartment complex in the same way the first woman was killed, and they tried him for the death of Wendy Prescott. And when they found him guilty, they introduced evidence of the Vietnamese lady who was killed. Plus, they called all 5 women who had been sexually assaulted, and all of them testified. And following that, it took a Tarrant County jury about 90 minutes to say he should get the death penalty.
There's some indication of future dangerousness evidence. Was that introduced in the trial or during the appeals?
No, what happened, and here's where you have a when you have a case like this, and when you sit from a defense viewpoint, you realize that there's not any way in the world you're ever going to have a client found not guilty, and you realize the only issue is going to be either going to kill him or give him life. So the approach the defense lawyers took, and I think it was the only approach they could take, is to try to prove that he would not be danger living in a prison environment. Because they could say, look, he can get a life sentence, he lived in a prison environment, wouldn't be dangerous. So what they did, they tried to develop that line of testimony saying, you know, we can't turn this guy loose, but we can put him in a controlled environment, he won't be dangerous. So here's what they did. And here's the dangerous thing about any time you testify, and I like to think of a lot of this evidence being like a wave. You can ride a wave in on a surfboard, but the undertow will drown you if you're not careful, because there's always comes things that come back and bite you. So what he does, they call a psychologist who did, and I'm not too sure, this is always very impressive with most Texas juries, and said this guy only had something, if he got into a prison society, it would be like an 18% chance that he would ever be a danger to anybody in the prison population. I think they said the general statistic, like 16% of the people are dangerous, he'd be in the 18% category. But what happened, the state turned that over and said, look, we've already proved a probability of danger. There's an 18% possibility he's going to hurt somebody.
Hmm.
So they flipped that back over. That
so you had the undertow.
So you ride the surf in, proving up that other half, but you forget that person gets on cross-examination, and when they're cross-examined, they say, well,
and that 18% would look pretty good on that CD if you had one.
Yeah. And then here's where, and this is, and I don't know why lawyers do this. We've cautioned against this. You should never, ever, as a rule of thumb, unless you're really mad at your client, you never call anybody that works for the state as a defense witness. Now, this case was a guy named S.O. Woods, and he's been, I think when they built TDC, S.O. Woods was probably there.
I think that he was left on Red McCaskill's doorstep.
Well, there was an ark might have parked him there, right. But he's been there for, anyway, he's in charge of classification.
Right, I remember when he was in charge.
So what happened? They called S.O. Woods, and what they were going to attempt to do through S.O. Woods, he works for the prison system.
Yeah, at that time he was classification
and
guru.
You don't really expect somebody working for the prison to be very sympathetic with the man who's been found guilty of murdering and raping a woman. You're not going to find... But anyway, they call S.O. Woods, and the reason they called S.O. Woods, they wanted to be able to prove to the jury the different levels of security inside of a Texas prison. That he would be in a high-level security area and be very secure and, you know, no great danger of
escaping.
No
outside trustee for him.
Stuff. All that sounds real good on direct. But guess what? When he gets on cross-examination, the prosecutor says, well, let's talk about the weapons that are available in prison. And here all this came in. You know, prisoners have shanks, they have knives, they kill each other.
They work all day in the field with hose.
And lo and behold, they had busted this guy in jail with a shank. And so what happened, again, that undertow came in. You know, you ride the wave of proving that he could be in a high-risk area, but when you do, you give up that undertow of being able to prove all the stuff that's available to people in prison and the kind of weapons they have. That's what S.O. Wood, he gutted them. And I could say... It was a calculated risk. That's about all they could do. There was no evidence ever of any type of what we call mitigating evidence, like a traumatic childhood, that would cause this. And so what happened, that was basically the big flap on appeal. They tried to argue the lawyers were ineffective for presenting that evidence. Well, what else did they have? You know, and here's something that, and I wish we would explore this some, because we're all real big on being against the death penalty, but truthfully, what do we do in the system when we have somebody like this who's obviously a serial rapist, who is dangerous, who not only assaults women and sexually assaults them, but brutalizes them, beats them, and chokes them to death? Now, when we get them, what do we do with them? What's the solution? Now, one thing I'm curious about your response to this. If you remember, about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a man here in town in Mike McSpadden's court. He was a pedophile. And he didn't say he didn't want to be a pedophile. And he said to help him control his urge, he agreed to be sexually, to be surgically castrated,
mm-hmm.
to control his sexual impulses if they would give him probation or consider it. And McSpadden considered that and got into a big flap about it.
I remember that case. I remember that flap. I editorialized about it on
All
the
right.
Prison Show.
And I'm curious about your response, because I got real curious and I began to read. And in Europe, one of the things they've been doing consistently for years with people who, if you're a serial rapist or if you're a pedophile who can't control a sexual urge, what they've been doing is permitting some form of medical or surgical castration, either through medication or actually through surgical castration. I'm just curious about your response. What are we
Well, there are cases. In the case, you understand that I spent some time at the University of Indiana at Kinsey Institute. I mean, one of the things that I did during my college bum years is I went to the Kinsey Institute to learn mostly about myself, but you also study sexual behavior there.
Right.
And there were several fine professors, John Money among them, C.A. Tripp among them. Karen Horney was there. She's a big psychologist. And there are tests, case histories of people who have been surgically castrated and then found to be performing sexual abuse with children after castration. So it's not a permanent fix.
Does it help, though?
Well, they would have to ask them questions that were not asked. All we have is the fact that some people have been castrated and went on to commit the same crimes that they were castrated for committing before. So the issue is, there is a whole panoply of human behavior that is not acceptable behavior. There are people that will kill people, but they wouldn't be so rude as to pick their nose at their mother's table. And so how are they able to control their nose picking? We're unable to control their killing.
Correct me if I'm in error, but when I read the article, there was, I think in Sweden, I forgot what country in Europe used, they used some type of medication.
Yeah, there's a chemical castration.
That slowly shrunk somebody's testicles or slowly shrunk,
sure.
Whatever. And they claim, in fact, I read this article in New Yorker magazine, that when they studied the recidivist rate, it was not as high among those who took the medication. It didn't cure everything.
Yeah.
But what they said in the particular studies that at least the New Yorker reported, that those who submitted to that procedure where they took medication and slowly shrunk their testicles, that they had a lower recidivist rate than those who did not participate in the program. And my question is, if you're a lawyer, if you're trying to keep a guy from having the death penalty, would you be willing to volunteer to have your client be
surgically? Well, I was going to ask a similar question about all this. I mean, you walk in the courtroom and you get this file. You're a court-appointed attorney. You're being paid to do this. This is what you do professionally, is you represent clients of this nature, and there's no guilt or innocent issue to be had. And then you've got this dude with this long history of really extreme behavior. What can a criminal defense lawyer do? Now, do you think that adding to the bargaining chip, the possibility of let's talk about some form of castration? And there's one thing about that chemical castration that is not true of the mechanical castration, the actual surgical castration, that the chemical castration requires treatment over a period of time.
Right.
And treatment over the period of time translates to a kind of supervision. And, I mean, you know, you come in to see your doctor to get your shot because you can't go to the, you can't buy it over the counter, you know, castration special this week.
You can get married, that'll right. work, right? You, same difference.
Right. It's same, that has the same overall
marriage
effect.
Marriage is a good castration yeah. technique. They just don't,
Yeah, well, right.
A little slower.
Yeah, but the deal is, it also is a form of cannibalism, but nevertheless, the deal is that you get into these awkward situations where you're actually reporting to somebody who says, you know, have you raped anybody lately? I mean, let me ask you these 10 questions. And that in itself has an effect on your behavior. I take it that people that commit this kind of crime, and I don't have any evidence of deep nature, but people that commit sexually compulsive crimes are for the most part loners. They're pretty much isolated. You don't find a lot of gregarious people out doing this sort of thing. They're people that are for whatever reason separated from the mainstream, and this is an activity. That's the way they've maintained their anonymity.
You bet. They're television evangelists, one of the two.
Well, television evangelists get more offers than you'd believe. I mean, Saving Soldier $5 piece, shrinking hemorrhoids without surgery is an amazing thing, and sexual stuff goes along with that. I mean, otherwise, why are all of these televangelists doing with all those bouffant hairdos like they were teenagers? Because the evangelist, there's a big cross. I was an evangelist.
All I'm saying, Ray, is I just think that that's one possibility that I'm not offended, but today's he's exploring the possibility.
Sure.
If that's something that would make somebody less dangerous and would keep somebody from getting the death penalty, then I think it's something we should at least discuss openly.
And if you can add it to the arsenal of a criminal defense.
Yeah, Otis has got a question.
Yeah, a question. First of all, there is some thinking that these so-called sexual crimes are not sexual. These are crimes of power. Rape is generally
for the most part a power crime.
The other thing is, I don't know his other history. He was repeating that same crime over and over.
Apparently.
He probably... I would think that without women around who looked a particular way and had bathtubs, he probably would not be a danger to other guys in the thing. And that apparently... Okay,
that's
Jim's smiling.
That's what they tried. That's why he got the death penalty. That's exactly what they tried.
Is that what they said? Or they were talking...
They tried to say that he would do real well in the structured environment of prison in a high security place.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the crime, his violence is brought on by this thing with women.
So?
If there are no women around...
Well, in prison, there are not a whole lot of women around.
Exactly. That's my point.
That's not true anymore. The typical prison employee guard is a woman of color, and that's the typical situation. But the thing about it is that if we as abolitionists, people who are opposed to death penalty and executions in class, if we don't have an answer for these questions, we're being brought up short.
That's a part of the death penalty, right?
Absolutely.
A part of what we should consider is ever realistic possibility to protect society short of killing somebody. And if that's something that may work, it's certainly something that we ought to be able to look at and should be an option available on the table. Well, that's all I'm saying. If it makes people less dangerous as opposed to killing them, then I say let's take a look at it. I'm not opposed.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that. And as a matter of fact, if you were expecting me to get all burly up, it's mutilation is nothing new in criminal justice. We've been doing it for thousands of years. There's other forms of mutilation, and if chemical castration, which is actually not cutting body parts off, has a lesser recidivism rate. But see, that lesser recidivism rate in and of itself is not all that persuasive. It's like that 18% chance that, you know, if you're looking for a return on your CD, 18 looks pretty good.
Yeah.
I'd like to go down and put $100 to the bank, draw 18% for a few years. That adds up pretty good. But the fact of the matter is that you raise a very serious question here. We're in the business in Texas of executing people on a very regular basis. And some of these cases, there's a lot wrong with some of these cases. And you and I have discussed similar cases. Go back to the archives. You'll find that we came to a conclusion that a guy was wrongfully executed executed not long ago. He might have been a bad dude, but that alone was not worth the execution, because we're not entirely sure he did the crime for which he was executed.
Correct.
And so the deal is that this is a bad dude. I mean, the facts of this case are not neat. This is not a pretty case. Facts of this case are indicative of some very serious danger to the public. And if we don't address those dangers, is Dennis back? All right, let me... Dennis?
Hello, Ray.
You're back on the air. I take it that the procedure has completed.
Yes, it must have gone off without a snag. The media representatives came out of the walls unit about 3 minutes ago. We never saw anyone go in to witness on behalf of Mr. Chanet, which is very, very saddening. It's always distressing when, for me especially distressing, when there are no witnesses for the condemned. Even though I know sometimes the guys prefer that their family members not come, I always wish that there was at least someone standing in their room.
Sound like it would be at least some comfort in a very desolate moment of the last moment of their life. Well, give our regards to the other vigilants.
Will do.
And I'm not going to be around this Thursday's execution, but someone else will be sitting in this chair to chat with you,
okay,
or whoever
well,
can report.
You know, I teach Thursday night, so I suppose Gloria may be back. We'll wish her well.
Sound like you've got a breeze up there.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. That is Professor Dr. Dennis Longmire of the University of Sam Houston University School of Criminal Justice. And since he lives in Sam Houston and criminal justice is his field, he is consistent with his vigilance in these things. What we're doing now is Elizabeth is going to call Dave Atwood, who is here in Houston. Dave is, I believe, at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd at St. Anne's Catholic Church, where they have been holding vigils in recent weeks. And so we're going to get him on the air, give him the bad news of this execution, and then we're going to find Professor James Acker, who is calling in from New York, and his textbook is The Future of America's Death Penalty. The subtitle, An Agenda for the Next Generation of Capital Punishment Research. You might pose this question to him, Jim. We might ask him. Your mic's hot. We'll ask him what he thinks about these alternatives, because I mean it's going to take all of our thinking. I mean, I remember at the IWY conference in 1977 in Houston, Margaret Mead was in town for that, mm-hmm. and they only gave her 7 minutes. And the first thing she said is, "Do not applaud during my speech. I can't afford to waste the time." And then she proceeded to supply us with a very serious thesis that the goals and the objectives of the women movement was going to basically be the end of the patriarchal Western society as we knew it. And that had side effects, and that we needed to plot and plan about how to strategize the new era. But we've got Dave Atwood on call here. Dave?
Yep.
You're on the air. Tell us where you are.
Corner Westheimer and Shepherd, out in front of St. Anne's Church.
Okay, the weather's kind of inclement. You got any company over there?
Well, we had a total of 5 people, and not too bad considering the weather. we got rained out a little bit, but it wasn't too bad.
Well, I've got to sadly inform you that the procedure has completed in Huntsville.
Yeah.
And Mr. Dale Devon Chianet has now been executed. This was not a pretty case. There wasn't any issues involving guilt or innocence and the issue of continued dangerousness. Maybe the attorneys made some bad choices in presenting that claim. But it doesn't really matter to you and the other vigilants whether these cases are neat and tidy at all, does it?
No, we're against it whatever reason, there was somebody that came up to me at our vigil today and was questioning, you know, why we were out there. And, you know, basically my answer is that it doesn't matter what terrible thing a person has done. We, the state of Texas, we don't have to do another terrible thing in response to that. We can do better than that. And you know, that's basically what my position is that this is not good for anybody, certainly not for the person executed, but not for the family of the victim, not for the state of Texas, not for the citizens of Texas. It just really is not good for anyone, and that's why we shouldn't be doing it.
Well, that raises the issue then of what do you do with people that constitute a persistent danger? And that's been kind of where our discussion has gone tonight, because this case didn't have a lot of surprises. Do you have any comments to make in that line?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a very secure prison system, and we can keep people in prison if they're dangerous. And I think that's the right response. I think we should treat them humanely while they're there, because we know that a lot of people do change dramatically when they're in prison. But that is the answer. And of course, the guy I was talking to tonight on the street was saying, "Well, they can get out." And I say, "Well, the prison system that I know is a pretty darn secure system. That doesn't mean that things can't happen. Things do happen every now and then, but it's very rare. And they usually make corrections when things do happen to make sure it doesn't happen again. But to me, that's the more humane, civilized way to approach this. But I really do believe that we've got to, while they're in there, for how long, no matter how long it is, they have to be treated humanely, no matter what they've done. And a lot of people, like I said, do change dramatically.
Well, if it's half as difficult to get out as it is to get in, and you and I do that from time to time, that's pretty secure.
Yeah, yeah. And, and the cases when somebody does get out, you know, when somebody escapes, is extremely rare. That's what people remember. They do remember it when it happens.
Oh, absolutely, every time.
Dramatic.
Well, we're talking here with Dave Atwood of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. They have a website, www.tcadp.org. That's tcadp.org. Dave, give our love and regards to the other vigilants, and we have another one of these things scheduled Thursday. We hope for a stay, but if that is not forthcoming, someone will be here to do the show.
Okay, fine, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was Dave Atwood, and that completes our reports from afar. I think all of us, Dave Atwood and the other activists, think about how to deal with people that constitute a continuing danger. I mean, I know people.
But Ray, it bothers me, the idea of just to lock some people up and that's it because they're dangerous. There should be more available than that. And all I'm saying is, and let's go back to what we talked about earlier about McSpadden. This guy, this is his idea.
Yeah.
He wanted to do it. If the defendant wants to be medically castrated by taking medications and agreeing to do it, should we have a procedure that permits that?
Well, what That's happened in that case?
They wouldn't do it. There was no procedure to permit that.
Did he not throw up in lieu of imprisonment? Do this
exactly. What had happened? That was the whole issue. Part of what he wanted to do, use this as a plea bargaining chip to get a probated sentence as opposed to going to prison. So he volunteered that he himself would be chemically castrated if they considered giving him probation. And McSpadden considered doing that, and he got a whole bunch of real bad press over that because they thought thought he was.
Yeah, I remember the publicity.
And it wasn't anything that he ordered. This was a suggestion made by a defense team, by a defense lawyer, and by a defendant, as opposed to going to prison. That idea that, you know, I think that's kind of. I'm not really impressed with the idea that if someone's dangerous, we just put them away and lock them up and leave them forever.
We have Dr. James Acker on the ad. Dr. Acker, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
And you are in New York?
I'm in Albany, New York.
You're in Albany. That's the very state capital.
That's right.
And are you a professor? What do you do?
I'm a professor in the School of Criminal Justice here at the University at Albany.
And you have a book, The Future of America's Death Penalty, An Agenda for the Next Generation of Capital Punishment Research. How did you come by that title?
My colleagues and I, Charlie Lanier and Bill Bowers, are very interested in doing objective research about the death penalty, its administrative effects, its cost, its benefits, that sort of thing. And we got together a group of what we think are the nation's leading researchers to try to identify for us issues that they thought would be the most important to the death penalty future. So the book involves the posing of questions and strategies for answering them that we hope will help inform policy about the death penalty.
What is the situation about executions in New York?
New York last had an execution in 1963. It's a state with quite a history of the death penalty, as I'm sure you know. It has surpassed Texas and almost all other states in terms of the number of executions that have been carried out under state authority. Although most of those were in early periods, and as I say, they finished in 1963. And then in the early 70s, New York's death penalty law, like those across the country, was declared unconstitutional. The legislature reenacted a death penalty statute that mandated death on conviction for capital murder, and that was declared unconstitutional in 1977, and then began a lengthy period where the state legislature enacted death penalty bills. There were two governors in New York, Hugh Carey and Mario Cuomo, who were opposed to the death penalty, and for the next about 17 years, they vetoed the legislation. And then Mario Cuomo was defeated for a fourth term in office by Governor George Pataki in 1994, and the state brought the death penalty back in 1995. It remained on the books for 9 years, and during that time, only seven offenders were sentenced to death row here in New York. Nobody was executed. The law in 2004 was declared unconstitutional by the state's high court, and the legislature, through some committees, considered whether to reenact the death penalty in 2005, and following public hearings, the assembly declined to allow any bills to come to a vote. So we've not had an operative death penalty law in the state now for 5 years.
So you literally do not have a legal means of executing people in New York State.
That's right. Since
and it's been a
before when the statute was declared unconstitutional, there hasn't been a mechanism for a state death penalty. There have been some federal prosecutions that have gone forward, but New Yorkers have done quite well, I think, without the death penalty for the past 5 years.
Okay, now. New York has some bad folks.
No doubt about that. We have our share of them.
Yeah, some of them it's just a personality thing. In Lower Manhattan, I've encountered those folks. But the fact of the matter is that you're getting along quite nicely without killing them. What suggestions do you have for Texans about bad folks that are deemed to be a continuing public danger? What happens to those folks?
Well, I don't think New York has any monopoly on bad people or on the solutions to what to do with them if they're not executed. It's no secret that many countries in the world manage to cope, and many states in the country manage to cope without the death penalty. And one of the very best researchers that I know in this area is doing business right there in Texas, John Sorensen, about alternatives to capital punishment and obviously life without parole. And Professor Sorensen's work has, I think, very vividly demonstrated that appropriately managed life term prisoners do not pose extraordinary safety risks, and in fact, in many, many cases are among the best adjusted in the prison population, and that certainly the outside community can be effectively protected by life without parole, and also corrections officers and fellow prisoners for the most part.
Well, it must seem bizarre to folks like you elsewhere in the country that we're in this studio frequently twice a week covering an execution which goes by with almost ritual time-kept procedure. As a matter of fact, we've discussed, I mean, why are these things so ritualized? And my partner here who gives legal description of what's going on said, well, it's easier to take any pill if you have a ritual to do it. And it is so ritualized in areas that have it. I mean, you write down everything they do for the day before they do it, and you give them some last meal, and somebody makes a recording of that, and then you go through a process of last words. It sounds like a ritual. Sounds like a religious service of some kind.
Sounds like a process that's pretty much ringed out any semblance of a recognition that there's a human being, many human beings that are involved. And you're quite right. I'm not been in New York, and I probably wouldn't have remembered anyway to have lived through a time when my state of New York was actually conducting an execution. And as I was thinking about talking with you tonight, it really was a almost surreal experience for me to really try to grasp the reality of what was going on in the state of Texas.
Well, this whole program, this conversation, is a product of fact that Texas had scheduled to kill someone at 6 o'clock, and that process was completed by 6:25. And we had reports from outside the death chamber, and we had reports from a vigil here in Houston. We covered the history of the case, and we're beginning to sound like a ritual.
Well, I think that your voice certainly needs to be heard, because without calling to the attention of people everywhere the reality of what underlies the ritual that you're describing, you know the slogan about enough good people doing nothing. Keep the show on the air by all means as long as necessary.
Well, the whole idea of this program grew out of the fact that it was very obvious that the next morning one-liner appears in the newspaper and that someone was executed the night before, and there's almost no prior to the event. It's almost as if out of sight, out of mind. And that seemed to be an unlikely thing for a sister station of WBAI in New York needs to do. And so we started this process. We just didn't realize we were going to be as busy as we have become.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you'd just as soon not be as busy.
Oh, we celebrate around here when there's a stay. And then a few weeks later, or a few months later, the same name appears on the schedule, and we've got to cope once again with the same thing, because this state is determined to kill people.
There was an enormous outpouring of support You could almost see demand for capital punishment here in New York following those several years of governor's vetoes. And then when the statute was enacted in 1995, we experienced the expenditure of approximately $200 million that, again, resulted in none of the perceived benefits that the supporters of the bill had envisioned. And when the law went away in 2004, it's been an experience where I honestly believe that, people collectively breathed a sigh of relief. We're not spending the money. We can begin to focus on hopefully more constructive criminal justice policies, rethink objectives of punishment, and it's almost been a breath of fresh air, and one wonders if it might find its way to Texas someday.
Well, Texas is a little slow. I mean, the pipeline down here, and it took us a while to get the Constitution, much less any creative thought about criminal justice. We've got this enormous criminal justice system, and the costs just keep going up, and all of that. So my co-host in here tonight and I've been discussing, what do we tell people when they say, all right, this dude is dangerous, his behavior is likely to continue. How do you protect the public from this individual person? We were even discussing castration for violent sexual criminals. What do you discuss in your classes at the School of Criminal Justice?
Well, you can always pose those scenarios that do undoubtedly promote safety. I mean, you mentioned castration. If there was a serial killer here in New York who had his signature was to bite his victims, and you know, you could
Lemuel Smith
nail him down and extract his teeth. You could chop off his arms.
My New York journalist friend says it was Lemuel Smith in Schenectady.
I was a copy editor in Schenectady and wound up becoming a police reporter right after he got sent to prison. And he committed another murder in prison, didn't he?
That's right. That's precisely what happened. You can usually get people to appreciate that there need to be limits on that safety issue, and if people are somewhat or considerably uneasy about lopping off body parts, you wonder why they aren't similarly uneasy about killing the body entirely. But again, the quick and easy answer is not easy, but life without parole, which has proven repeatedly to be quite effective. In most cases, it's not 100% effective, but as we know, juries and prosecutors aren't 100% infallible either, and you can't get back those innocent people executed. So.
The one thing that we haven't discussed tonight is the remarkable number of exonerations as police technology improves. And DNA and other things that exonerate. Well, we've been talking with Dr. James Acker, and he has he is a professor at the School of Criminal Justice at the State University of New York at Albany. His book is The Future of America's Death Penalty, an agenda for the next generation of capital punishment research. Raises it. It's a weighty book. It looks like a textbook, actually. Is that how it is used?
Yeah, well, we're hoping normal people will read it, too, but if academics pick it up, we'd be pleased.
That slam is yours, not mine, okay? And for information about the book, you can contact Carolina Academic Press at www.cap-press.com. And Dr. Acker, we appreciate you being on the Prison Show. We may call upon your largesse in the future if this madness continues.
I'll be waiting, and I'll be rooting for your show to keep doing the good work it's doing. It's been my pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you, sir.
Alrighty. Good evening.
Good evening. And that's Dr. Acker. Jim?
Yes.
We're back together for the rest of the show, and it's about 10 minutes till the end. Any comments? Could you hear anything?
Yeah, I heard everything you said. You know, the thing that bothers me, Ray, several things. Number one, you cannot separate the death penalty from prison reform. And number two, this idea that there's some great panacea because we have life without parole, that's a death sentence. I mean, what's the difference? You just wait longer till they die. I mean, to me, that's just as horrible as executing somebody.
Yeah,
without parole, to me, is not a good solution.
As a convict who prospered while he was in prison, I have had to give serious consideration. I don't know if I could prosper in prison if I were looking at doing the rest of my life there.
Well, I find that to be just a kind of a lame thing to say, well, we got life without parole. That is a death sentence. If you're against the death penalty, you should be against life without parole. And that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's waiting for somebody, you know, somebody else to kill you. And the next thing that really bothers me is this whole concept that we can just lock people away because they're dangerous. We should start doing, it just seems nutty to me. Then we have all these unemployed psychologists and all these unemployed psychiatrists running around. We don't use them in our prison system. I don't understand why we're not treating
them. No, Jim, you understand, and I don't know if people do understand because they haven't been there. Once you are in prison, the main thing is the operation of that small, contiguous sub-society. The warden is not worried about reforming anybody. The warden is only concerned with the operating the unit which he's in charge of.
In other words, you're a commodity.
You're a commodity. And it has an agricultural program. It may have an industrial program. It provides housing, food, health care, and you use the inmate labor to promulgate those aspects of prison life. Nobody in prison talks about rehabilitation. Now, if you want some education and you're willing to pay for it and you have the resources to pay for it, you may actually do that. You may actually go to school, and there are several avenues to do that, but you are going to pay for it because the state is not. There are no Pell Grants or anything to get people through college. They will give you a GED education for free, but then that is awkward to get into and something specifically unenthusiastic about perpetuating that program. The drug program and alcoholism treatment is virtually non-existent. They have one unit devoted to that out of 107 units, the Hamilton unit in College Station, Bryan College Station area, is a treatment center for that sort of thing. They have set up some units to handle sex offender treatment, and that's kind of a low-ball, semi-professional operation. I went to their conference in Houston, and the minute I walked in, they stopped everything. They stopped the workshops. They stopped the plenary sessions. I mean, I was an outsider with a press pass, and it's like it was a secret that what was going on there. And basically, I found out later from talking to one of the persons that I befriended while I was waiting for the police to tell them, no, this is a state-funded thing, and this man has press credentials, and we can't lock him. And I found out that what they were talking about is job expansion, how they could find more work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't have anything to do with procedures of how to effectively treat people for compulsive sexual behavior. Duh. It's a jobs program for some people. And effectiveness is never measured. I don't know, Jim. We raise these very serious questions about what to do with people that constitute a danger. And certainly the folks that are engaging in compulsive sexual behavior and killing people are a clear and present danger, and something needs to be done to them.
Now, take this guy, for example, you know, the number of rapes and then strangling people. As we've said before, you know, that's an extremely vicious crime in the sense it takes a while, it's very close proximity, a lot of violence involved in it, and anybody who would do a series of strangulations situations, normally is something wacky about them because it's you don't just die in a minute or so. It's kind of a gory way to die.
And there's got to be some motivation for that.
And then the way he assaulted the other women that he sexually assaulted, it wasn't just like one of these, it wasn't a date rape, I can assure you of that.
No, it wasn't like getting a little nookie after dinner and the dance. And the duct tape, the whole thing is bizarre and should be considered bizarre. And the guy that does it should be considered a danger and a continuing danger, and what to do with that person.
Exactly.
So I will pose it to the listeners. Send us some suggestions. What do we do in a case like this that might give us alternatives to... We are seeking alternatives.
I have to pose this question, Ray. What would be their idea if a man, like, say this, for example, this guy gets caught, if he voluntarily wanted to be medically castrated, should that procedure be available? If that's what he wants to do, as an option that he should have available and the defense team should have available, as opposed to putting him in prison for life or killing, giving him the death penalty, should that option be explored? I'd like some people to explore that possibility.
Explore that possibility and give us something. And you can write us here at radio station KPFT. Write us in care of the Prison Show, but we have a box as the Prison Show. We do not have a box as Execution Watch, but if you'll write it to the Prison Show and put Execution Watch on the outside of the envelope, we'll give your letters to Elizabeth to sort through and give us some guides for future program. You're listening to Execution Watch. We're a program that comes on this radio station, KPFT HD Channel 2, every time Texas executes somebody. We're on for an hour, from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. We have a website. It's called executionwatch.org. It is maintained by our electronic and producing wizard, Otis McClay. Otis keeps their website and keeps this program on the air because it takes a great deal of engineering to make this happen. Our executive producer is Elizabeth Stein. Elizabeth works very hard in preparing each program. The other voice that you've heard through most of the program is Jim Skelton. Jim Skelton is a practicing attorney who continues teaching other attorneys about the ebb and flow of the state of the law. He's a very well-liked, prestigious person in Houston's legal community who comes down here because he didn't have to dress up to do radio. And I'm Ray Hill, and I do the Prison Show. And we have just taken on a new member of the gang. Marlo, what's Marlo's last name?
Marlo Blue.
Marlo Blue is, we stole her right from KPFT News Department and brought her over to Execution Watch, and she's actually going to be sitting in this chair this coming Thursday. And I think that the staff of this program, all of which are volunteers, do a wonderful job of keeping you informed about the grim business of Texas Execution Chamber. This is nothing to be proud of in Texas. We're not doing this in a bragging way. We're doing this in a way where we hope to explore some alternatives, your ideas as well as our own, in trying to eliminate the ugly practice of executing people in Texas. Texas now is the execution capital in this country. Harris County, if it were a separate state, would be the third largest executioner in the country. And so we are at the heart of the problem. We're in the place where there can be and should be a difference made. I want to thank you for listening. This is KPFT HD Channel 2. You may also be listening to us on executionwatch.org. I'm Ray Hill, and good night.
I was fresh out of the service, it was back in 82. I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could become.